This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. It being the end of the year, we're taking a look back at some of the most memorable moments of 2013, courtesy of our doctor in the house, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and his conversations with Meera Sivasodhi. In the last year, we've covered some of the biggest medical stories, from the weird and wacky to the genuinely groundbreaking, alongside some distinguished guests from specialist fields. Let's kick things off with a story that caught Dr. George's eye in April 2013, which was the dramatic disappearance of Neon Roberts with his mother Sally for 4 days. Here's the story.
You just want to go through the case. Neon Roberts is a 7-year-old boy who had a brain tumour. It was a very rare form of sort of tumour, isn't it, George?
It is, indeed. You know how I got to learn about this case? It was just before Christmas last year, and it was 21st of December when Mrs. Roberts decided to disappear. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that was when I was actually traveling with my family in a very, very rural part of Istanbul, rural part of Turkey, somewhere called Cappadocia. And in that place, the only channel that was in English was actually BBC. Okay. And that was something that I just carry on following. The background of story, essentially, is a 7-year-old boy has got this very rare brain tumour. Mm-hmm. And a year prior to that, this child actually underwent surgery. And at the end of the surgery, a year on, and he had a scan, and the scan showed that there was some tumour that actually recurred or remained. Mm-hmm. So all the doctors suggested that Neon, at that time was Child A, presumably, or Child X, usually because we don't name children's, you know, in cases like
which
this.
In this case they did.
I know. So therefore, you know, we got legal experts, we got pediatric oncologists. I'm extremely excited to see, you know, what's your view on these issues.
Yeah.
So on the 21st of December, when we were watching the news, Neon's mum had decided that against all the doctor's advice, Neon is not to undergo further treatment, including surgery and radiotherapy, mm-hmm. because she described it as plain barbaric and absolute torture, mm-hmm. you know. So obviously, with that situation, you know, the judge actually say that this is every parent's nightmare. You can actually feel it, you know. On one hand, you see a 7-year-old child completely helpless and needing medical attention, because the medical experts all said within 3 months of not having this treatment, he was going to die.
That's right.
And then on the other hand, a mother who's absolutely desperate seeing the child suffering and not knowing what the evidence is like, not really convinced that the treatment itself was going to help the child. Mm-hmm. So we're in a situation like this.
This threw up a multitude of issues, mostly to do with parental and clinical responsibility and how those two may be at odds.
To me, as a urologist, what's interesting is that from this point onwards, because all this time we assume that a child doesn't give consent until adulthood.
Yeah.
So it will have to be parental consent. So in many ways, you know, we talked about this before in the past about circumcision, mm-hmm. something very simple. And then, you know, we looked at the Berlin court ruling about circumcisions, about how a doctor is being charged not for negligence, but actually for mutilations.
Mm-hmm.
So in this way, it is the other way around, you know. So if you actually have a child, let's say, for example, for me, I treat a boy with both kidneys with stones, mm-hmm. let's say something simple. I know that if he doesn't get this treatment, he is going to get kidney failure, mm-hmm. for example. So it's in his best interest to do that. However, if the mother actually brought the child in, is from Kelantan, and decided that, you know, in my hometown, there are better herbal medicine in order to do that. And then in the case that I, at the current moment, before Neon's case, I always assume that I have no rights to force the mother. I can persuade, you know, most of the time I can be charming enough to persuade.
Oh, for goodness sakes, George.
However, in the event that I can't persuade, do I have any legal rights or clinician's responsibility in order to activate legal system to force a child to undergo such treatment? Because cancer is one thing. The other thing is losing kidney is not any less traumatic than cancer. So can I in any way deal with that similar situation where a mother decided to take the child to have herbal medicine instead, which have absolutely no evidence at all? However, I would suggest that he would undergo treatment for the kidney stone, which is a lot more mainstream.
Accompanying Dr. George Lee in addressing the story was Professor Hani Arifin, consultant pediatric oncologist, and she had strong words to say about those who were vilifying Sally Roberts, the mother in the case.
The mother is not a villain. She wants what's best for her child. I think she has been ill-advised. And I think doctors versus parents on two sides of the fence should is a very, very sad situation. She's desperate. She loves her son and very much. And I think she needs more support and better counselling rather than being vilified as an irresponsible parent, which is not.
Ultimately, though, the story has had a happy ending. A story that was published on the 23rd of December 2013 in a New Zealand newspaper stated that Neon has been given the all clear from the brain tumour that saw his mother battle with British health authorities. The tumour has been removed by surgery in October, and his father Ben Roberts has stated that Neon is now in remission. Heading into June then, the story that dominated the headlines was of course Angelina Jolie and her decision to have a preventative double mastectomy when she discovered that she carried the BRCA mutation that put her at 87% likelihood of developing breast cancer, which was the disease that both her mother and aunt had passed away from. What Dr. George had to say at the time was a fair representation of the buzz and conversations that surrounded that decision.
One person was suggesting that it was very brave of her to do something like that. The other person would actually say, hang on a minute, you know, but the consequence, a snowballing effect of somebody who is doing that is completely mind-boggling because it can head the wrong direction if it's not under control. Others were saying that she's attention seeker, but I think that she doesn't need any attention.
Dr. Nur Aisha Taib, consultant breast surgeon, was also part of the conversation and helped with clarifying exactly what the BRCA gene is.
Well, everybody has the BRCA gene. It's whether you have an abnormality in that gene. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, this is something that everybody has and it can be inherited. So if you have one of the genes which is abnormal, you may be able to pass that down to the next generation, but it's not 100% risk that will be transferred down to the next generation.
Okay.
So it's only like every time a woman gets pregnant, and if she carries the mutation, the baby has a risk of having, it's about 50% risk. So one in two chance, she will transfer the mutated gene to the offspring.
Okay.
So it's not 100% transmission.
Yoon Suk Yee of CARIF gave her perspective as a genetic counsellor.
I think it's really important to understand that the attention needs to go to the right category of people. Mm-hmm. We're talking about BRCA testing, which is really only applicable to a small proportion of the public. Mm-hmm. Majority of the public will not fit genetic testing criteria, which really means this is really for individuals who have high risk based on family history or the age of the onset of their cancers, or for very young cancers, or indication that there is a familial trait of cancers in the family. Mm-hmm. So, but the really good thing about it, like Prof. Aisha said, it has brought forward many more high-risk individuals. So we've got more of those coming in now. And of course, we do have the worried well, they have come in as well. But it's good that they come in so that we can also then
reassure them
and then give them the right information. There's so much misinformation out there right now, and that's something that we worry about because, you know, the internet has been spreading the pros
like
and cons
wildfire.
Of her, you
right.
know,
yeah.
and all sorts of other information which really isn't very true. So, you know, we really think that everyone that is worried or is keen to find out a lot more to get the information from the right sources.
While the debate might have died down a little, the issues brought up by the case continue to be relevant. What it boils down to, however, is that people with a family history of breast cancer today have options, and it's important to understand.
For individuals who have the family history, do come forward and get the right information so that you can make your own choices. There are ways to access testing and risk management, and certainly, you know, speak to your doctors about it.
This is a review of sorts of some of the big medical headlines to come our way in 2013 and how Dr. George Lee, our doctor in the house, addressed them with a little help of some friends. Stay with us on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and we're looking back at some of the more interesting stories that have arisen this year and that our doctor in the house has addressed. Moving on to July, of course, one of the big stories of the year has been how e-cigarettes have become ever-present, and are starting to be used pretty consistently for people who are considering quitting smoking. And there was an article in the BBC that stated that the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency says it will regulate e-cigarettes as medicines when new European tobacco laws come into force. As a urologist, Dr. George explained the types of cigarette and tobacco-related diseases he often saw and why this article piqued his interest.
Actually, I had a patient who came to see me, and essentially, prior to that,
Real or not, this story?
Of course, okay. Naturally. And so this patient who came to see me, essentially, for men who come to see me with smoking-related diseases in urology, will primarily be in the form of either bladder cancer, because bladder cancer is one of those cancers that actually is is induced by smoking, and also the other thing, which is erectile dysfunction, because clearly with the insult or the attack of the kind of like the components in cigarettes, and then result in men having problems with the vessel supplying the vital organs. Right.
I remember, in the past you did a show on smoking in relation to penile and testicular cancer.
That's right. And well, it's penile cancer and bladder cancer.
Okay,
that's right. Yeah. So penile cancer it is associated with smoking, and also bladder cancer is associated with smoking. Erectile dysfunction. So when we get a situation like that, especially erectile dysfunction, you try to advise patient to stop smoking. Mm-hmm. And then he came to clinic a month ago with this device called the e-cigarette, which I've never heard before, right? Because I usually will just send somebody to my friend, Rabin, to say, you need to quit smoking, you need to see a psychiatrist to help you to overcome your childhood problems and that sort of thing. So, and blame your parents. And
he also talked about the ramifications of regulating e-cigarettes as a medical device.
And I heard mentioned in the news that e-cigarette is now kind of like, being used as, medical product and things like that. Therefore, I just think this is a fantastic topic to talk about. Number one, we want to, and analyze when somebody has to go through quitting smoking. I want Dr. Rabin to tell me what sort of like process do they go through, what's the success rate and things like that whenever they try to kick a habit. Mm-hmm. And then number two, we're also going to perhaps get a phone call from a chest physician to see whether this e-cigarette, is it a cause of concern?
The conversation revolved around addiction and methods of quitting. Finally, though, Dr. Rabin Gonzaga, a psychiatric expert, puts it down to everyone needing to follow their own way.
Regulating e-cigarettes, I think it's all up in the air at the moment, but I think as far as smoking is concerned and e-cigarettes are concerned, I think everyone's got to do what you've got to do. You've got your own journey to follow. So you've got to decide what's best for yourself and, follow your decisions, I guess.
You've got to be really strong for that, though.
When we talked about the dangers of smoking, I think in this day and age, everyone knows the dangers of smoking. You can't pick up a packet of cigarettes without seeing a baby, like a fetus or a gangrenous foot.
You still get people who are in denial, right? They say, I don't know that cigarettes are harmful.
I don't think it's about denial. I think it's about, it's just ignoring the evidence, I mean, we all know that too much sugar is bad for, bad for you, but then lots of people will have 5 Tay Tariqs a day or, put sugar in their coffee or whatever it is. High fructose corn syrup is the next new dirty word at the moment. But yet we consume products that contain them. So we're all kind of guilty of doing things that are not good for us. So I don't see smokers necessarily as any different. It's just that, they've got this blind spot as far as cigarettes go.
Like the way you put that, blind spot. I have blind spots for too much eating, really.
Hence the blue pill.
That's right.
Your message, George.
Yeah. My message is it's all very hazy. Right, okay.
Is that the vapor?
That's right, it's a vapor. That's right, okay. And then a lot of regulations up in the flames. All right, okay. And what I think I support, I think, banning it, perhaps it's, in many countries might be drastic. But I think the UK, National Institute of Clinical Excellence made good decisions. Mm-hmm. They phased this out over a period of 3 years. And over this period of time, and then a lot of research work is being done. And in order to find out true amount of medication that nicotine that should be delivered to patients, yeah, and then in a highly regulated way. I really think that's a way forward.
Yeah, but I think we should even start regulating or do something about it.
Because this device, I guess, you know, kind of like creeped in so, nearly overnight, and then since 2000, and then now it becomes so big that it really needs to be regulated. Like, you know, Dr. Rabin was saying that so many companies are producing them, and in different companies actually have different amount of solvent and nicotine in it. It truly cannot be delivered that to patients. No.
And in September, the story that spilled over the front pages of local dailies was that of a Bosnian man, Ervin Ababovic, claiming that his ex-girlfriend had abused his sperm so that she could bear a child with superior European genes. For that show, on the 9th of September 2013, we called in the big guns combination of fertility specialist Datuk Dr. Prashant Nadkarni and our resident geneticist Dr. Arif Anwar. Here, Dr. George elucidates the issues surrounding the case.
And when you look at superiority, you know, we're looking at aspects in the sense of sporting achievement. We can look at aspects in intelligence and all sorts of different aspects. So, you know, if this case was actually arguing that the child is supposed to be taller and more handsome of mixed ethnicity, many people would actually accept that. But to actually say that, you know, it's a superior gene pool, I think that part is stretching your imagination a little bit too far.
There are, of course, also issues of consent, which Dr. Prashant, being in his area of interest, is all too familiar with. Here he explains what could happen with frozen embryos.
You know, it's a big field, isn't it? Consent. There's a third thing, which is very common. People do IVF, they freeze the embryos. Yes. They may or may not have a child, and then they separate. Mm-hmm. Then who owns the embryos?
Mm.
And then if you get married again, half of that embryo is yours, right? So you can bring your other partner and say, well, I want this embryo put back. So it happens all the time in the field that we work with, and we have to tread really carefully.
Aside from the salacious and serious matters the story threw up, there were also emotional components to it, as there always are with any breakdown of a relationship.
It's a public breakdown of a relationship. That's all it is, if you come down to it. And he's using an angle to embarrass his wife into submission, or his girlfriend or his partner into submission. I think that's all it boils down to, and we're all having a bit of a chat about it.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. But the serious side of things, obviously, is this issue of consent. You know, it'd never stand in court, really, will it? Because if that case, it actually is a test case that he wins, every single divorces can be used on the same ground to say that the sperm had been abused. And then, you know, it's clearly, that's right.
It will set precedent, really.
And both doctors' final messages, while humorous, are cautionary and look forward to the future of the child as opposed to the shared parental past.
My message would be careful who you get into bed with at the end of the day.
We finally, you know, prove that the superiority is, it's rubbish.
It's in your mind, isn't it?
Yeah, it's in your mind.
You think you're superior, therefore you're superior. Really, are you superior?
Well, Victor, gently put it as BS, right?
Okay, yeah.
That's possibly. Okay.
And the other thing is this.
So I think, you know, it's interesting that when a marriage or a relationship breaks up, it's a painful problems to go through. However, to actually publicly go through this actually will multiply this whole thing by 1,000, 10,000 times, and then one really have to think about the other person who is the collateral damage as a child.
Also in September, we continued the theme of examining fatherhood in all different guises and from many different perspectives. When a study was published that linked successful and nurturing fatherhood with testicle size, Dr. George enlisted Dr. John Benloy, licensed marriage and family therapist, to examine the evolution of fatherhood.
It's a study, a US study, where researchers had 70 fathers of kids 1 to 2 years old. They looked at pictures of their own children, as well as unfamiliar children and adults, while they underwent, you know, fMRI scans, right? And the wives of the fathers also filled out questionnaires to rate how involved the dads were in raising those children.
That's right.
For an example, how often they changed diapers, how often they stayed at home from work if the child was sick, and whether or not they fed and bathed these children. And then came the good part of this research. Testicle size and testosterone levels were measured to see what connection there might be with their role as fathers and how involved they really were. It turned out that men who were more involved in their kids' upbringing had smaller testicles and lower testosterone levels. So there you go.
Dr. George compares the study to what happens in the animal kingdom and wonders how it's linked.
In the evolution viewpoint, what they're highlighting is that, you know, it's almost like an animal situation, because when you look at animal studies, you look at the testosterone level, the higher it is, then the more likely the animal is going to involve in mating activities rather than nurturing activities. In the kind of lower testosterone levels, then you're more likely to nurture your offsprings rather than busy mating, because you don't want to waste your energy. Mm-hmm. And then so they are actually applying this particular theory to human.
Dr. John Ben Loy worried over how the study would be received and whether it would make men trepidatious.
Well, first of all, I couldn't help but laugh and think, wow, is that really true? And then secondly, I thought, well, this is kind of no win, isn't it? I mean, if I'm a good father, then
I'm going to have smaller
should
balls.
Should I?
That's
no.
Right.
And I dare not look.
And, you know, and if I were, you know, had, you know, bigger manhood, then I'm going to be a bad father. Mm-hmm. So either way, you sort of lose.
A lot of the episode was spent ruminating on what it means to be a good father, especially in a changing modern culture.
An involved father, it really ranges, and I think culture also plays a part. A lot of it also has to do with perception in terms of how the mother and the children are perceiving what a good father is. But let's look at what is not a good father. So someone who's abusive physically or verbally, someone who is also neglectful or not present. Yeah. So within a range of behaviors that is humanly considered, here is a acceptable behavior for a father or any parent could constitute good involved fathering.
Mira, Dr. George and Dr. John Ben all agreed that Asian culture in both our men and women also had a role to play in modern fatherhood with a more nurturing approach.
I think it's because we have higher testosterone in Asia, and that might play. I don't know. I think it's a cultural thing that when you're in an environment where, you know, it's so distinct that the male role is breadwinners and female role is, you know, childbearing and also looking after, and even in that society, when you get a woman working in an environment, and then you also get that hierarchy problems. You know, you get the acceptance of more female colleagues and things like that. So that prejudice remains in an environment when it is more male dominated, and then that cross, you know, that will cut across in the industry and also at home.
However, the study was conducted on a small scale, 70 men in Atlanta, and both doctors assured listeners that in this case at least, size truly might not matter. Heading into October, a headline announced that Sweden was the best place to be old in the world, which had Dr. George wondering, where would he like to retire, and with the publication of the study of different countries, would that change?
Let me elaborate a little bit about this study, okay? Essentially, we're looking at 91 countries across the globe, projecting that by 2050, we're going to have 22% of our nation considered to be, our global population considered to be old, above 60 years old. And obviously, different countries are taking different measures in order to help the aging nations. And we're assessing these index according to four domains. The four domains include income security. Under income security, you're looking at pension incomes coverage. Do you think Malaysia has got reasonable pension income coverage?
I would hope so.
Have you got your pension?
I do.
You do?
I do.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Okay. Do you think you will grow or you have enough money to spend by the time you're 60 by the savings of pensions that you have at the moment?
Yes.
Oh, see, let's hear it from you guys, you know, to hear it. Then the other thing is a poverty rate at old age. That is an interesting thing because obviously poverty line, it's quite well defined. At old age, at 60 years old, you're still considered poor. How many population will still have that? Income security, relative welfare of older population and GDP. Per capita, and that falls under the income security. Other areas is health status, or because a lot of us are considering that. I used to work in this place in England called Southend. Southend is where all the East Enders actually retire to the beach and that sort of thing. And I always thought about the healthcare system. You know, what is the life expectancy of men around that age at age of 60? Health life expectancy at age of 60 and psychological well-being. I really think those are important parameters.
For me, one of the key things, and perhaps this is coming from my family background, my father is of retirement age but continues to work because he wants to.
Absolutely.
And so the idea of, you know, employment and education is very important.
I really think that's important. I really think Singapore is doing reasonably well, because every time you go to Singapore, you do see that, you know, like for example, when you land on Changi, you actually see that, you know, perhaps senior, you know, citizens are working in a taxi ranks,
fast
food joints and things. I really think that whenever you have a situation where it is a cultural norm to employ the age population, it should really be good. And I really think that your dad's kind of like a example is good. And then that is one of the domains. When you look at employment and education, employment of older people, facilities to do that is one of the index, and educational status of older people. So opportunity for them to actually educate themselves in the future. I really think that's crucially important. And then there are several countries, such as Sri Lanka is doing very well in this, is because of these parameters that they take.
Dr. George's Bali dream ultimately was one that is perhaps not meant to be.
I mean, the best place on earth for me will be Bali Island. You know, it's just so nice, paradise and things like that. So as soon as I kind of like thought about that and said, is this nation actually, it's a good provision for somebody who's growing old? Interestingly enough, out of 1 to 91 countries, where do you think Indonesia stands?
I would say maybe somewhere in the middle.
Somewhere in the middle. So you would think that, you know, we're looking at about 30, or maybe 40,
thereabouts,
45.
Yeah.
Indonesia is number 71.
As we and the rest of the world are quickly becoming an aging populace, the study comes at an appropriate time.
Believe it or not, by 2050, we're going to have an aging world.
In fact, in Malaysia alone, by 2035, more than 7% of our population will be 60 years and older.
Are you kidding?
No.
Is that right?
So 2035. And that's not far off at all. According to the National Statistic Department, the Malaysian population aged 65 and over is projected to increase more than threefold of the 2010 population. And what this means is that, ironically, just as we hit 2020, we're going to become an aging population by 2021. Replies to the question, where would you like to retire, poured in fast, with answers ranging from the south of France to Chiang Mai. But without exception, people's concerns were the same. Mobility, social connections and healthcare were always present. Dr. George ends the show by asking the question, is Malaysia doing enough?
I think we have to do more because, you know, are we doing enough? I don't know. I don't think I'm in a position to kind of like know exactly how much more we're doing. However, increasingly, we are seeing men who are, because in my work, I deal with many aging men with aging problems. That includes prostate enlargement, prostate cancer. And then I think with the current resources that we have, we will see some degree of stretch of the healthcare system whenever we are seeing this large number of population entering that age group that will require healthcare. I really think that we can do more. You know, every single nations that's on that list can see we can do more. I really think that we need to focus a lot more in terms of the preventive, healthcare provision and also, you know, supportive healthcare provision in the future.
And finally, on the 15th of November, Dr. George is accompanied to our studio by Jody Nikolic, a patient with a neuropathic bladder.
Almost 2 years ago, I had a car accident. Actually, I was a cyclist. Prior to my accident, I was very, very fit. Mm-hmm. Competed in duathlons and triathlons and runs and marathons and all these outdoor exercises. It was a training cycle on a Wednesday morning, November 30, 2011. We always cycle early in the morning. We leave home at 5:30 because mm-hmm. the road's very quiet. And basically, we were coming home from the cycle, and out of nowhere, a car came from behind and just smashed into my back. Mm-hmm. I went flying through the air, something like out of E.T., flying through the air, landed on the ground. And as soon as I think I blacked out for about a minute, as soon as I woke up, I was laying on my side, and I said to my friends who were all gathered around me, there was five cyclists that day, I can't feel my legs. I couldn't feel anything from the waist down. And every time I took a breath, there was this crackling right through my rib cage, lower rib. So, cut a long story short, I went to the hospital. The MRI showed that at the thoracic 10 and a level 11 area, I had a spinal cord injury. And basically, my spinal cord, the vertebrae around the spinal cord smashed and cut the spinal cord. Mm-hmm. I'm actually an incomplete paraplegic, so I just have a string of spinal cord still on my left-hand side. I woke up from that. I was in hospital for three months exactly, and they told me, the doctors told me that pretty well I'll never walk again.
Dr. George explains how Jodie's injury caused her condition.
But the problem about bladder is that bladder is a reservoir. And then to have the reservoir itself, it's not enough because our body is an extremely intricate system of inputs and output nervous system. So basically, the story itself that BBC came out with, which is a research work done in the University of Cambridge, describing what would happen to somebody who has got severed spinal cord. And essentially, in our body, for example, let's talk about physiology. So in a normal situation, you're sitting here, you're doing your show. When your bladder is full, it has a capacity of about 300 mils, and then it tells your brain to process it in somewhere called maturation center, and then says to you that it's about to be full. So that signal, it's a controlled by stretch receptor going into the spinal cord, and then the spinal cord will transmit it to the brain. And when it's full enough, then your brain will transmit down to spinal cord and say, okay, you need to go to a socially acceptable place to evacuate this, okay. I.e. the toilet, right? Okay, so it will hold it with a sphincter holding it and not contracting. Until you reach a point of no return, you say, look, I can't hold it anymore, then it will contract. So that itself needs the input, processing in the brain, the transmissions from spinal cord to the brain, and outlet. So you have efferent and afferent. So when there is a severed spinal cord, which is spinal cord injury, for example, during car accidents or children who suffers from spinal bifida, for example, then this is a condition called neuropathic bladder.
They were discussing a study published in Science Translational Medicine that showed a device to read the remaining nerve signals could be used to control the organ, thereby restoring bladder function to patients with spinal cord injuries. The headline called it a prosthetic bladder. While it isn't quite that, it is nevertheless very promising.
In a nutshell, it's that it is a nerve. It's replacing the nerve. Let's say, for example, if this machine now is used in human in order to see whether this will benefit patients in Jodie's situation. Essentially, this is a wire that will emulate the actual efferent, the actual afferent nerve, which means that it will sense the bladder being full. Once you've set the actual level of fullness, then it will process it in her body, telling her it's full, and then it will send some signal to the brain and say, okay, you can go to the toilet to empty the bladder now. When she goes, that contraction of the bladder together with relaxation or sphincter will actually make it as natural as possible. And this is exactly how good it is going to be. It's going to be absolutely a landmark because it's going to change many people's lives.
Jodie discusses how something that many of us take for granted as a mere bodily function is something that she dreams of being able to do.
Sounds great. There's nothing I would like more than to be able to sit on the toilet and pee normally. I miss the feeling. You don't know how you know, it's simple things that you miss. No, it would be lovely.
And Dr. George's final message is one of hope for science and research to return dignity to people's lives.
I think there are many, many technologies in the world that actually come out to help different people. In our country, we sometimes look at technology and then we're completely mesmerized by that. But the reality is that there are many, many more things we need to do first before we focus onto that technology. I mean, we need to reflect on ourselves first, as a society, how we view, you know, first of all, safety, road safety. It is that is a paramount problem in our country. And the second thing is how we provide healthcare as integrated system. And lastly, how the society perceives someone who is, you know, disabled and misfortunate to have that before we look into technology. Coming back to this about technology, I really think that the other thing is that research is doing wonderful thing in order to answer questions about the defect of neuropathic bladder. And I really am quite optimistic, although this was done on a rat, but we have seen that the neural modulations in the 1980s that actually worked. But that was in the absence of computerization. I really think that these days with the microchip computerization and everything, and then this is something that is promising, hopefully within the next 2 years, we'll be able to see something.
Wonderful.
And that concludes our look back at the year that was and the stories that captured our hearts and minds. On behalf of everyone here at The Bigger Picture and Dr. George Lee, here's looking forward to an innovative and hopeful 2014. You've been listening to a special episode of Doctor in the House on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.